Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is David Casey. He writes on his blog at articulatingthefuture.weebly.com. That's articulatingthefuture.weebly.com, and enjoys backpacking, listening to indie rock, and reading as many books as he can get his hands on. Today, we talk about the end of civilization. So in your, what I thought was excellent essay called Thermodynamic Failure Phase 2, you had a line that really struck me, which is, by 2020, industrial civilization is going to suffer a massive stroke. By 2025, it will be in hospice. By 2030, it will be dead. So can you take us through that process?
Yeah, definitely. So first of all, thank you for having me on, Derek. It's a pleasure and an honor. That was... That was supposed to be a provocative sentence or three there. So my entire premise is based around the fact that the future is just going to be really different from the past, and especially the next 10 years, especially different from the last 10. The coming years are just going to be marked by a lot of shocks to the system. Industrial civilization is really coming down. I have an article on my website that's called Historical Perspective, which I really recommend to friends and family to kind of start with, because it shows the lead up. It shows the beginning of the story, right? So up until about 1800, which is really only, 200 something years ago, the world population had never gotten over 1 billion people. And that's kind of crazy to think of. So we have tens of thousands of years of history. And then up until 1800, the population had never gone over a billion. So between 1800 and 1900, for that 100-year period, about a 1.5 billion more people were added. So that brings the total to about 2.5. In the year about 1900. So then today we have, it's 2017, we have over 7.5 billion people on this planet. And that's just in the last 117 years from 1900 when we had 1.5 billion. Completely mind-blowing. It is to me. So I say in the article, for about 99% of human history, the Earth has never had a population above a billion people. In only the last about 200 years, the human population has exploded from 1 to 7.5. It's crazy. So the question there is, how did this happen? How is it that for tens of thousands of years, our population never gets over 1? Then suddenly explodes in 200 years to 7.5 and above. And the obvious answer there is fossil fuels, right? So we started taking this energy and creating industrial civilization, is what we call it now, which has been great, quote unquote, for humans, and has been horrible for our planet. So we have extraordinary, unprecedented growth. It allows all these technological marvels. It allows this society where we have cell phones, computers. We are connected everywhere. We can see our planet from space. But it's doing unthinkable damage to this planet. And it won't be, historically speaking, very long-lasting. This has only been 200 years, and it's about to come down. So we have this mind-boggling growth, and
so can
yet... Sorry, go ahead.
I was wondering if we can back up for just a second, and can you talk about... Can you be really explicit about why fossil fuels have... A, what are fossil fuels, and B, how have they... What is it that has caused this growth in both technology and human population because of fossil fuels?
Well, so when you look at graphs, right, you see the graph of human population. So it goes, I've got one that shows all the way back to 1050, right? And then it goes, it barely goes up at all until you hit late 1800s, 1900s, 1950, it starts going exponential, just goes crazy up, right? And at the same time, you have this graph of world energy consumption, and it does the same thing. It's barely going up. And then 1950, it just goes crazy. It goes exponential. So the two are obviously correlated. We have the population growth, we have per capita consumption, and we have total consumption on the planet of nuclear gas, oil, coal, hydroelectric, wood, everything, all these sources of energy. All this extraordinary growth has only been because of fossil fuels. It's the only reason that we've been able to grow our population so high.
And what is it about fossil fuels that allows that? Why are they so special compared to other
forms? I'm thinking that
listeners might be remotely acquainted with the term with the phrase EROI. Does it have to do with mm-hmm. that? And the energy return on investment?
Definitely. So what we have is and I have it here somewhere. There's basically the concept is that it's called EROEI, Energy Return on Energy Invested, which basically means what it says. You put in energy to get out energy. So if you put in, say, a barrel's worth of oil and you get back 100 barrels worth of oil for that energy that you invested, you're doing real well. I had a slightly easier way to explain it in that article you're talking about. So basically it's like if you give somebody a dollar of currency, right? And they give you back 100, and you do this constantly, they're like, look, I'm going to give you $100 every single time you give me one. And you're like, sweet, man. Like, you're going to start making money hand over fist. You're going to be making money so fast your head's going to spin. Then imagine you start doing this with this person, and you start buying things. You start investing. You get multiple houses all around the world. You start living like a billionaire, basically. You get yachts. You get all these cool cars you always wanted. You staff it. Hundreds of people are there to take care of your every need. But then imagine that as time goes on, you get less and less money back. Suddenly, your money doesn't go as far as it used to. Suddenly, you're in debt. You can't you can't continue this lavish lifestyle, right? Eventually, you're not going to be able to afford all these lavish things. You have to cut back on your spending. So when things get seriously tight for you, and this happens to everybody, when things get seriously tight for you, you can go into the red, you can go into debt, but that doesn't stop the system. As long as you're continually getting less and less and less and less back every time you put it in, then you just can't afford this lifestyle. The bankruptcy is certain. You can't continue this indefinitely if you're getting back less and less money every time you give this guy a dollar. He's giving you $20 now. You can't do that. And that's, that's really the analogy, I guess, that's most simplistic for me. So as a civilization, this is the situation we've come to. We built our civilization on high energy return on energy invested ratios. Multiple studies have given estimates of, at the beginning we were getting back 100 to 1. And today we're down to a global ratio of probably about 14 to 1.
So to be clear about what this means is that at first with oil, you could basically scoop it up and then burn it. So you're only putting out the energy to scoop it up, and then you get back as much as energy as you get when you burn it. And then after that, they had to drill down to 50 feet, and that takes more energy than scooping, but it doesn't take as much energy as when you have to drill down to 1,000 feet. And then by now, they're having to do shale oil, they're having to do the fracking, they're having to do the deep water, they're having to do it up in the Arctic, or they have to do it in places that are out in the middle of the ocean. So the point is that it's taking them a lot more energy. Like Saudi Arabia, evidently, one of their advantages is that it's really easy for them to, the oil they have has a high energy return on investment, which is why they can sell it for so cheap. And then other places like the shale oil, the tar sands, it takes a lot of work to get the energy out. Am I being accurate on this so far?
Definitely, yes.
Okay, so that's basically what you're talking about, that it used to be that you could scoop it up or you can just drill a little bit, and now you got to go out off the coast of Louisiana or you got to frack, you got to do some other weird thing.
Well, right, and this is the difference between what they call conventional and unconventional oils, right? So conventional oil peaked globally in 2005, 2006. The IEA says 2006, other places say 2005, but pretty much everybody agrees that somewhere in 2005, 2006, conventional oil peaked. It peaked in global world production. And what we're left with is unconventional sources. So when we talk about unconventional oil, we're talking tar sands, we're talking shale, fracking, deep offshore wells. And really the difference here is that EROEI, the energy return on energy invested. So obviously, you see all those old videos, right, of like the 1950s, 40s, whatever, and they literally drill down, and this black ooze starts like literally gushing out like a volcano.
They're called gushers.
And that's right in Texas and all these places. Like you see this, that's very, very easy, cheap to extract, cheap to refine, very easily gotten oil. When you're 400 miles off the coast and you're drilling down 18 miles or more, obviously this costs more, right? So these sources are just more energy intensive to procure, as well as prohibitively expensive. The only way the companies have been able to extract from them has been by going into massive debt. And I mean massive debt. The unconventional oil also, the other big point to this is that the unconventional oil, it just, we've gone so far in debt to acquire it, but it also provides such a small fraction of the net energy that we've come to expect as a civilization from those conventional sources. So it's really a question of availability and net energy. So we can't just say, I don't know, a lot of people out there hear the term peak oil, right? They hear peak oil and I really don't understand the freak out people have about it. Because peak oil, in its most simplistic form, just means that any well or series of wells will eventually peak in production and then decline. And there's nothing you can do about it. There's no like amount of technology you can bring to the table, no amount of money you can bring to the table. The amount of oil you're getting out of that well or series of wells will decline. So it's not a theory. It's not something that people can really argue about. The thing that people argue about is whether we're at peak, whether we're going to peak soon, whether we have peaks, that sort of thing globally. But really, the peak oil, the term that has come to encompass everything, is really about that availability and net energy. What kind of availability do we have? Do we have to go offshore to get it? Do we have to frack to get it? How much is it costing us? Are the companies that are doing this, are they profitable? They're not. And Richard Heinberg has this amazing quote. And in it, he says oil no longer provides as much of a stimulus to the economy. It just can't grow as it did before, and this in turn sets in motion a self-reinforcing feedback loop of stagnating or falling labor productivity, falling wages, falling consumption, reduced ability to repay debt, failure to invest in future energy productivity, falling energy supplies, falling tax revenues, and so on. How long can debt continue to substitute for energy before the next traumatic phase of this feedback process begins in earnest? I mean, all those things are things that we see in motion right now in our economies of the world. Falling wages, falling consumption, reduced ability to repay debt. This is a failure to invest in future energy productivity, falling energy supplies. Like, these are the things that we see constantly in our day-to-day lives in the news headlines. So the conclusion to all of that is that all of these things just add up to one big thing. We're going to head into a new era. This thermodynamic collapse that I talks about, it's coming way sooner than most people think. And I'm not, like, I'm just some guy. I read a lot. You know what I mean? I'm in my mid-30s. I have no, I don't even have a degree. Like, I'm just some dude. But other people, the CEO of Saudi Aramco, Ad Amin Nasir, just this past July was at the World Petroleum Congress in Istanbul. And he said there that the world is heading towards an oil supply shortage before too long as a result of falling discoveries of new conventional oil reserves and steep drops in new investments. And at that same conference in Istanbul last July, Mark Richard, who's the Senior Vice President for Global Business Development at Halliburton, said that the industry's slashing of about $2 trillion in investments will weigh heavily on the market in the few years when oil supplies fail to keep up with demand, and will lead to massive oil shocks when the market catches up, which, according to him, will happen somewhere around 2020 to 2021. That's like 3 years from now, man. Like, this isn't me. These are like Halliburton and Saudi Aramco. This is the big players. These guys are telling us that this is going to happen in 3 years. If we remember back to 2008, we saw oil prices spike. They spiked to about $147 a barrel, and then we had the global financial crisis. And so in that provocative little quote at the beginning where I said that we're going to have a massive stroke by 2020, this is what I'm talking about. When this thing hits, things are going to start deteriorating much more rapidly. This second phase of this thermodynamic collapse that I talk about, that's when it's happening. It's going to happen in 3 years, give or take. Go ahead with your question.
So a couple things. One of them is you said, in there, in those quotes, you said basically a failure of investment. So does this mean that, and you and I both know that from my perspective, civilization coming down is a good thing because it'll be a good thing for the planet. Mm-hmm. But we're going to leave that aside for a minute, and we're going to pretend that I want civilization to continue. And does this mean that we could solve this problem? Since they said it's a failure of investment, does that mean that investment alone would solve it? Just throw a boatload of money at searching for new sources of oil, etc. Would that, from their perspective, save the day, or are there structural reasons that wouldn't work?
So we're coming up on, and I use this phrase for a reason, limits to growth. And I say I use that phrase for a reason because there was a limits to growth study in the early 70s, right? And they have since, in 2000 and 2001, one of those years, and also in 2005, they did two follow-up studies to this. And a lot of people dismiss this limits to growth study, right? It was demonized in the media for years, for decades. So they did this in the early 70s. Computers were just starting to become a thing, so they did some computer modeling. A lot of people think that the limits to growth study predicted that all of this was going to happen, and it didn't at all. What they did was they had 12, I believe, I could be wrong, but they had 10 to 12, something like that, predictive computer models of the future, right? 3 to 4 of them, if I remember correctly, actually led to a what they called a stable world scenario. And there was one that was their standard run scenario, their business as usual scenario. And that one is the one that all historical data for 3+ decades tracked. So they did a follow-up study, like I said, in 2000, 2001, somewhere about there in 2005. And I have the graphs. It shows the predictive model of the standard run scenario from the early 70s, and it shows 3 decades worth of actual historical data of what actually happened. And it shows that what we have done has followed their standard run scenario, which was 1 of 12. It wasn't a prediction. It was just 1 of 12 models, right? And those we have, so we have that 3 decades worth of data. So what does that tell us? It tells us that we are on track for the outcome that that model predicted. And that model predicted that by 2025, we would see large increases of death rates. We would see large decreases of food production. We would see all these things that people that talk about collapse talk about, right? And it gave us the date of about 2025. And we have 3 decades worth of model or of historical data to back up that 1 out of 12 models. So I talk about limits to growth, and your question, I guess, to get back to it, I'm a bit long-winded, was to say, if we threw more money at the problem, right, would it go away? The problem right now is that all of this, well, okay, there's 2 problems. The first is that all the money that we've been throwing at it so far for this unconventional oil has been debt-based. And 2, we've been decreasing our amount of upstream oil and gas investment since 2014. So now, 3 years later, even if we threw more debt money at the problem, we're already 3 years into a trend of not throwing enough money into the problem. So we have, from 2014 to 2015, the oil and gas investment into the future dropped by 25%. From 2015 to 2016, it dropped by 24%. And that's the most numbers I have now. But clearly, according to Saudi Aramco and Halliburton, the amount of total investment in the future has dropped by about $2 trillion. So we're about $2 trillion short, and that will hit the economy in 2020, 2021, whatever your guess is, basically, but about 3 years from now.
So because we can presume that the head of Halliburton, the head of Saudi Aramco, their primary concerns are making money, as opposed to they don't want to produce oil for the hell of it or extract oil for the hell of it. So we can presume that if their investment is going down, a primary reason that the investment is going down is because it is not profitable to invest. Is that accurate?
Right. So,
which has to do with the energy return on investment, because if you only had to invest $10 to get back a barrel of oil, then that's one thing. But if you have to invest $500 to get back a barrel of oil, then you're not going to do it. Am I still following correctly?
Yes. So there's a few things here that I wanted to mention.
Because it's very complex stuff, I think.
It really is. It is. The overall concept, I think, is super simplistic, easy to grasp, I guess. And that easy to grasp concept is just that we are out of all the cheap and easy to extract oil, right? And now we're down to the extremely difficult to extract, very expensive oil.
So it's kind of like you've grabbed the donuts out of the middle of the box, and now you're searching for crumbs on the floor.
Right. And I think Chris Martinson, Alice Friedman, geez, there's so many others that have talked about this, and I don't know where it originated, but the drunk at the party, he's got, you know, his kegger, and that's gone, and then he's got his beer, and it's gone, and now he's literally down on the floor sucking the beer out of the carpet.
You know, I used to know someone who was a crack addict who said there's a phrase for that among crack addicts. It was called ghost busting, which is that you will search the floor looking for any little spare bit of crack, and you'll end up smoking a piece of a Dorito because you can't. I mean, maybe you may have a tiny bit of crack on there, which of course points to the addiction of this whole culture, since we're doing the same thing.
Right. And what are we addicted to? We're addicted to growth. Anything. I mean, it wasn't up until like what, 2014 or so, when oil prices started decreasing significantly, the Fed, the IMF, they started saying like anything below, before that they were saying anything below 3% year over year growth in GDP was a recession. Nowadays they don't say that anymore. Now it's you know, we have 1 point something year over year GDP growth, and that's good. But that's just a side effect of this net energy problem that we have. In any case, to get back to your question here. So we have just a very recent, this year, HSBC, global financial company, that's, I think they're based in London. They work out of Hong Kong. I don't know. But in any case, they're a global financial company. They have a report that concluded that total oil production has peaked in 81% of all oil producing countries on the planet. 81% of all oil producing countries on the planet. That's kind of crazy to me. But the report's most shocking finding, even more over than that, was that the world will need to add 4 Saudi Arabia's worth of production by 2040 just to keep production flat against declining rates, against current declining rates. We need to add 4 Saudi Arabia's by the year 2040. That's not going to happen. And a lot of this is based on North American unconventional production, all the shale oil that we find in the U.S. and Canada.
Which, by the way, we've been leaving off as we've been discussing this, and this is fine, but both you and I know that these shale oils, the fracking, the deep water, all of these not only are more expensive, but they're much more environmentally expensive.
Well, yeah, certainly. So
anyway, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, please.
So we have another report that was out last year by the Deloitte Group. They showed that over 35% of all independent oil companies worldwide declared bankruptcy last year in 2016. 35%. And another 30% are projected to follow in this year, in 2017. So that leaves only about a third of all worldwide independent oil companies standing by a year from now. That's insane. So another report I had by SRS Roco, which is an amazing, great company. They have some really good YouTube videos if you ever check them out. They showed some graphs for the big names in oil. like ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and they show these top three U.S. oil companies, the net income from 2011 to 2016 has just plummeted. I mean, it's insane. And then those same three companies, Exxon, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips, their long-term debt from 2011 to 2016 has skyrocketed. They're barely treading water. And these are the biggest names in oil. These are the big names. And then on top of that, you have, what is that, 60-something percent of all the independent companies all have gone bankrupt or are going bankrupt right now. There's, I don't know, like, I don't know what to even say to that. But back to your question, I guess, is, you know, we have these different price ranges, right? So each country has a break-even price on their oil, like how much it's going to profit them to sell it at. And this is all based on like money, dollars per barrel. So this is why we see like Venezuela right now is in a insane economic crisis, but everyone says they're sitting on such vast reserves of oil. They have more oil than Saudi Arabia. But the problem here is that their oil is extremely, extremely heavy crude bitumen. It's really heavy oil that is very difficult and very, very costly to extract, whereas the oil in Saudi Arabia, say, is much more of the conventional type. It's much easier to extract, much more cost effective to extract.
So what's
but wrong? We have, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
So we have all the different countries that, like I said, 81% of all oil producing countries have hit their peak, are now in decline. But what about the rest of them?
So we have
Libya, Iran, Algeria, Nigeria, Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar. They all have a different break-even price where they can sell their oil for a set amount of money and they can make profits. But not a single one of them, not a single oil-producing country is balancing its budget right now. None of them are producing profits.
So who cares if they have to jack the price up to $200 a barrel to make money? I mean, we need oil, otherwise we can't run our lawnmowers. So and in fact, as you know, as we all know, we're eating oil. So what happens to the economy if the price gets jacked way up, so that Venezuela can make a profit? I mean, what is problematical about that from an economic perspective?
Well, the problem is that I think it's, gosh, I can't remember who it is that originally said it, but it's been going around the Dumosphere, the collapsosphere, however you want to talk about it. But basically, the concept here is that if you have, say that like $75 per barrel is the break-even price where most countries could maintain a profit. But on the other side, you have this situation where, because of slow and non-existent, really, economic growth from the last 3 years, has created a situation where the consumer in aggregate, in total, cannot afford a barrel of oil price over $50 a barrel, say. So that puts us in kind of this rock and a hard place, right? So the consumer in aggregate cannot afford oil over $50 a barrel, but the oil producing nations and the companies cannot make a profit unless oil is at $75 or more per barrel.
So two things.
And that's, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
And that's really the situation that we find ourselves in right now.
So I was going to say two things. One of them is that the problem then is that if oil is high enough that the oil companies and the oil countries can make a profit, that means my bread is going to cost me $15 a loaf, which I can't afford. Which means right. that I'm also not going to buy gas for my lawnmower, which means that eventually the lawnmower companies are going to go out of business, and that's going to drive more people to unemployment, obviously using lawnmower manufacturers as a stand-in for everybody else. But the point is, if everything's so expensive, I won't be able to afford it. On the other hand, if oil is cheap, that means my bread is still down $3 a loaf, and I can buy the bread. But all the oil companies got a business, which means that there's no oil to run the economy, which means that bread is going to go back up to $15 a. is this sort of what's going on?
Yeah, it's this death spiral, right? You know, and that goes back to this Heinberg quote that I quoted earlier, right? So he says that this sets in motion a self-reinforcing feedback loop where stagnating or falling labor productivity, falling wages, falling consumption, reduced ability to repay their debt, failure to invest in future energy productivity, falling energy supplies, falling tax revenues. These things continue and continue and continue. It's a self-reinforcing feedback loop where neither side can win. If the oil prices are low, we get the same result. If the oil prices are high, we get the same result.
So really, peak oil, the real way to think about this is not peak oil like they're absolutely running out of oil, but instead the way to think about this is the end of cheap oil with the implications of what that means. Because you could have oil at $20 a barrel back when it was cheap and you were just scooping it up. And they could make a profit and you still have cheap bread, you still have cheap lawnmowers. And then when it goes up, I mean, so thank you for being so clear about that. I want to go a different direction slightly. We have about 10 minutes left. And before we start to wind down, I have another direction to go, which is I can hear a lot of sort of bright greens or the Mark Jacobson crowd going, but wait, it's great that oil prices are going up because we can run the entire economy, no problem, on wind and solar. So this is actually fabulous news because, I mean, you've heard this, right?
Definitely.
So this is actually great news. This is the end of coal, the end of oil, and we are going to have our cheap, you know, our $3, $2 a loaf bread, and we're going to have our lawnmowers, and they're going to be solar lawnmowers.
Yeah.
And I'm having a joking tone, but you and I both know that this is pretty close to what they're saying.
Well, first of all, and a lot of your listeners and readers probably understand this point, is that we don't want industrial civilization to continue on unabated. We do not want that. I mean, look at the graph of population growth. Look at that next graph of fossil fuel use. And then there's another graph, which is extinction of animals. And it follows the exact same trajectory. So we're destroying our planet. We're in the sixth mass extinction event. By the year 2100, if things continue, we'll kill off 75% of all animals on Earth. Like, it's insane. So your readers and listeners probably understand that point. The second point, though, is that we have this narrative that is being pushed that renewables are the solution, right? We have this, particularly wind and solar. Wind and solar are going to save us. We're going to create these massive wind turbines. We're going to build roads with oil to go take these trucks that use, you know, a gallon of oil per 30 seconds to drive these giant wind turbines made with oil up onto this hill. And we're going to put them up and they're going to kill birds. And we're going to, you know, we're going to power civilization with this stuff. And really, they mean this. They're like, you know, they're going to save us. And by save us, they mean allow us to continue our way of life unhindered into the future. The problem here is that not only that we're killing off our planet, but also the problem with it, technically, is that we all those sources, the wind, the solar, they have a lower and lower EROEI. They have a lower and lower energy return on energy invested. We invest all this energy to produce this thing, and it only gives us back, you know, wind and solar are like 3 to 1. We can't run civilization on this. A lot of studies have been showing that we need at least, at minimum, a 12 to 14 EROEI overall in order to power civilization as we know it, with all the side benefits that we have. But this, yeah, this whole renewables thing is fantasy, and a lot of people don't like to hear that. But on the other hand, I'm not pushing against renewables. I think that renewables are a great resilience effort for the individual and for the community. I think that they, even if these solar panels and wind turbines and hydroelectric dams and whatnot will only work and cannot be replaced for, say, 5 years, up to 20 years in some cases, that may be a good resilience effort for communities, for individuals in their homes, to ride out the chaos, but it's certainly not going to power civilization. We have had industrial civilization was built on this, like I said, 100-to-1 ratio. These renewables are 3-to-1. Sometimes they're even negative EROEI. It takes more money, more effort, more energy to build them than they're even giving back. It's insane. The projected infrastructure costs of changing over the entire infrastructure, all the cars, all the things that make civilization run, has been estimated to take at least 20 years, and it has and costs somewhere in the trillions of dollars, like $3 to $5 trillion, according to multiple different studies. We do not have 20 years. There is no way we're going to be seeing huge, huge interruptions in services in 3 years. And that next decade, 2020 to 2030, give or take a year, is going to see a huge, huge decrease, step down in standards of living, in major public services being available to people. And renewables, according to all the experts, will not be able to save us. It will be an excellent option, I think, for survivors, for preppers, for people who want to depend on those things to power their homes, to take hot showers, to make life a bit easier in that transition, but it's not going to save society.
To which I believe the blue whales say, thank goodness.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, that was my other point there too, was I'm sure a lot of people listening to this are aware, but like I said, that graph of species extinction, it's really unthinkable. It really is. One half of all species are threatened with extinction due to industrial activity. And if we don't do anything, if nothing happens, then one half of all species will be gone by the end of this century. That's 1 in 4 mammal species, 1 in 8 bird species, 1 in 3 amphibian species. And the estimates go everywhere. They say, some people say we could lose 50% of all species currently alive today. Some say it could wipe out as many as 90% of all species living today. And all of that within the next 75 years. And that's one human lifetime. That should be mind-blowing to people. Why would we want industrial civilization to continue doing this to our planet?
So, which, by the way, also this mass extinction is much faster than even the ones that we've read about, you know, at the in the deep, deep history, the previous mass extinctions, we hear about them happening, quote, overnight. But by overnight, they mean 10,000 years. They don't mean 100.
Yeah, and that's what they call it, the sixth mass extinction event. So we have to assume that there were five previous ones, right? But what's the difference between this and the previous five? And the difference between this extinction event and the past five is that this one is directly caused by humans' impact on the planet, and primarily through our incredible growth rate, which is based on fossil fuels.
So we have like 2 minutes left, and I have two questions. The first one is, why do you write this? What good do you think it does to cast your voice about this? What do you hope that you would accomplish having put this analysis into the world? And then I'll ask my other question after that.
Okay. Well, first of all, my blog is a very humble blog. The article that you were referencing, that thermodynamic collapse phase two, that in the 3-day period saw over 1,000 views, which is insane to me because my normal view count is somewhere about, on average, about 20 a day. So it's not like it's a big blog. I started this thing because I wanted a place where I could put down my thoughts, and my thinking goes everywhere. So I need a place to put together everything so that I understand it better. And two, it was somewhere I thought I could point friends and family to be like, they're like, yeah, but you know, I heard on MSN that renewables and solar, man, that's great. And I would just have a ready-made response. I would just be like, yeah, here's a link to my renewables article. Please take a look at it, read over it, and see what you think, and then come back to me and we can talk about it more. And that's really where it began, and where I don't make any money off of it. I just kind of started writing to get my thoughts together and to kind of share with friends and family, and I don't think that it will ever really get big, and I don't expect it to, and it doesn't matter to me much at this point. I think starting in 3 years from now, give or take a year, things are going to get shitty. Really, they're going to start getting bad. And when those effects start hitting people, I think they will start paying more attention. And when things start hitting their bank accounts and hitting their lifestyles is when I think they'll start paying attention. And not until then. I think how many people can I reach in the intervening time period? Not many. And I'm not really out there to do that, to help people change their minds about what they think the future holds. I'm really just putting my fingers to the keyboard just have a place to show people where my thoughts are.
So my last question, and see if you can do this in less than a minute, is so say that tomorrow Donald Trump were impeached, and Mike Pence were decided that he wanted to abscond to Barbados, and Paul Ryan was unavailable, and then so all of a sudden the powers that be decide to make you the emperor of the economic transition away from this current way of living to what is coming. what would you do? So the question is, really, you and I both know that this culture is completely insane and won't follow reasonable policy suggestions.
Exactly.
But let's pretend for a moment that you could, with the understanding you have, make some policy to make it so the landing is as as least horrible for all humans and non-humans as possible. What would you do? What is your policy? Are your policies?
I would tell the truth. That's Like, there is literally, and I've talked about this before, there is literally no national policy. There is no president, there is no vice president, there is no congress member, there is no one who is standing up and telling us this is a problem and this is why it's a problem. And there is no nothing, absolutely nothing that can be changed. If there was a totalitarian regime and they could change anything they wanted, there is literally nothing that will change this outcome. Not a damn thing. And people don't want to hear that. They want to hear that if we implemented whatever policies, that we could continue unabated into the future. But we cannot. It's a fundamental problem that has been 40 decades or more too late. We were warned way back in the early 70s, and there's nothing we could do. If I was emperor, I would literally hold a press conference, make sure every single radio and every single TV show was showing nothing but my words, and tell them the truth and let it go. And then I would dissolve the damn government because the government does nothing good. There is nothing that can be done by the government. We cannot look to others for a solution. We can't. We have to look to ourselves and our communities. We have to become resilient as individuals. We have to create resilience measures for our community. We have to become those people who take responsibility and take action ourselves. We can't continue looking to these government leaders and filling out petitions and hoping that somebody will be fired and somebody better will take their place. It's way, way, way too late for that.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been David Casey. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.